We would like to send out a special thanks to the fun and challenging June's Journey game. Who doesn't love a good mystery? In the hidden object murder mystery game, June's Journey, you'll awaken your inner sleuth and step right into a thrilling adventure set in the heart of the Roaring Twenties. Find your inner detective. Download June's Journey free today on the Apple App Store or Google Play. Enjoy the episode. August 12th, 1989. Halifax, Nova Scotia. After her shift ends 40 minutes earlier than scheduled, 19-year-old Kimberly McAndrew clocks out and leaves her workplace before she vanishes without a trace. Over the years, investigators check out a number of different leads and even consult with a so-called psychic detective, but fail to find any conclusive answers about what happened to Kim. Even though a sex offender named Andrew Paul Johnson is looked at as a potential suspect in Kim's disappearance and a couple of other unsolved murders from the Halifax area, there is no conclusive evidence to implicate him, and Kim remains a missing person. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and on this episode, we're going to be covering a missing persons case from our podcast's home country of Canada, the 1989 disappearance of Kimberly McAndrew. As you might have heard, last month The Trail Went Cold reached a milestone in which we covered at least one cold case from all 50 American states, so our next goal is to eventually do the same thing for every Canadian province and territory. At the time of this recording, we're about halfway there, but believe it or not, we have never done a case from the Maritimes, so I thought now would be an ideal time to do an episode about what is probably the most famous unsolved disappearance from the province of Nova Scotia. I've received numerous requests to cover this from listeners, and it's already been featured on a number of prominent true crime podcasts, including Trace Evidence, Dark Poutine, and the Nighttime Podcast. It's one of those frustrating missing persons cases in which there's very little evidence to go on, as after completing her shift at a Canadian tire store and leaving earlier than she had originally been scheduled, Kimberly McAndrew just seemed to vanish into thin air. It seemed obvious that Kim was abducted shortly after exiting the store, but no one saw or heard anything, and even though investigators have explored a number of different leads these past 3 decades, they have yet to figure out what happened to her. The Halifax Regional Police have faced criticism for a number of missteps which have taken place in the investigation, including the involvement of a self-proclaimed psychic detective named Noreen Rainier, who really didn't do much good. There have been a few potential suspects, with one of the most promising being an habitual sex offender named Andrew Paul Johnson, who could be placed in the Halifax area at the time Kim went missing, and had a troubling history of luring or attempting to lure young female victims into his vehicle. But if Johnson had any involvement, he's not talking, and the only conclusive fact we know after all these years is that Kimberly McAndrew is still a missing person. Anyway, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of these sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the disappearance of Kimberly McAndrew. Our story begins in Nova Scotia in 1989, and our central figure is 19-year-old Kimberly McAndrew, who goes by the name Kim. Kim's father, Cyril McAndrew, originally hailed from Ireland and was a sergeant with the Royal Canadian Mounted Police aka the RCMP, and together with his wife Audrey, they raised 5 daughters and a son. The McAndrews lived in a number of rural communities before settling in Parsboro, but Kim and 2 of her sisters, Heather and Aaron, decided to relocate to the province's capital city of Halifax and moved into an apartment together. At this point, Kim is an undergraduate student at Dalhousie University and is currently working a summer job as a cashier at a Canadian Tire store located on Quinpool Road. On August the 12th, Kim went to work her shift, which was scheduled to end at 5 p.m. The plan was for Kim's boyfriend, her sister Heather, and Heather's boyfriend to come pick her up because they were all planning to attend the Halifax Busker Festival that night in order to celebrate Kim's boyfriend's birthday. However, when the group arrived at the store at 5 o'clock, Kim was not there to meet them, and they soon learned that since it had been a slow, quiet day at the store, her supervisor had given her permission to leave early. Kim clocked out at 4:21 p.m. and was last seen exiting out the store's back door, and since her apartment was only a 15-minute walk away, it's possible she was planning to meet up with everyone there before they left to pick her up. But when Heather and the 2 boyfriends drove to the Canadian Tire, they traveled the same route that Kim likely would have walked and did not recall seeing her at all. When the group returned to the apartment, it was apparent that Kim never arrived there, as all of her clothing and personal belongings were left behind, and the only item she would have had on her was a blue knapsack she always carried to work. After Kim failed to resurface, her family became concerned enough to contact the Halifax Regional Police to officially report her missing. Everyone who knew Kim found it unlikely that she would have taken off voluntarily, as her bank account was never touched, and she missed a dental appointment to have her braces removed, which was scheduled 3 days after she disappeared. Kim was also known for being uneasy when approached by strangers, and if her 2 sisters ever went out of town, Kim would actually travel back to Parsboro to stay with her parents rather than spend a night alone in her apartment. In spite of this, there was a reported eyewitness sighting of Kim from an employee at the Gardenia Flower Shop at the Penhorn Mall, located in the adjacent municipality of Dartmouth. The employee claimed that Kim had stopped by in order to purchase a balloon and a rose during the early evening hours on the same day she disappeared, but there was skepticism over the idea that Kim would make such an unnecessary side trip, particularly since there was another flower shop located on the route she would have walked from the Canadian Tire to her apartment. For 2 years, the investigation into Kim's disappearance failed to turn up any trace of her, but on December the 6th, 1991, the McAndrew family received a major shock when they turned into a local newscast and heard that Kim had been found alive. The announcement was made by Dana Walker, the president of an organization called Child Find Nova Scotia, who initially stated that Kim did not wish to make contact with anyone. It would soon come out that Kim had changed her name and recently given birth to a baby at a hospital in London, Ontario, but within a week, law enforcement publicly confirmed that this young woman who gave birth was not actually Kimberly McAndrew, but rather someone who looked like her and just happened to share the same birth date. Needless to say, this false lead was very traumatic for the McAndrews, and Child Find Nova Scotia would face heavy criticism for making a public announcement without speaking with the family first or confirming with law enforcement that the woman from London was Kim. Well, nearly 4 years later, in October of 1995, there would be additional controversy when Constable Dave McDonald of the Halifax Regional Police, who had recently become the new lead investigator on Kim's case, decided to seek assistance from Noreen Rainier, a self-proclaimed psychic detective from Orlando, Florida. Earlier that same year, Rainier had been featured on an episode of Unsolved Mysteries because she reportedly specialized in psychometry, where she could hold on to an item that once belonged to a missing or murdered victim and become that person. Rainier claimed that she would have visions from the point of view of these victims during the last moments of their lives, so she was often brought in by law enforcement to assist with homicide and missing persons investigations in hopes that her so-called visions would help provide them with a crucial clue. While Constable McDonald would have a total of 3 sessions with Rainier over the phone in hopes that she might provide information to help the Kimberly McAndrew investigation. In fact, Kim's mother Audrey and her sister Heather would be present for the first session and witness Rainier alternate between speaking as herself and speaking as Kim while supposedly channeling her spirit. Rainier expressed her belief that Kim's body would be found by Christmas and stated that it would be a quote-unquote nice Christmas present for everybody. But needless to say, this never came to fruition. Years later, the original audio recordings of Rainier's three sessions were sent to Tim Bousquet, the founder and editor of the Halifax Examiner, who shared them in an extensive article he published about the case in February of 2016. The article was very critical of how Rainier's intervention hampered the investigation, and Gary P. Posner would later publish his own scathing article about the situation in the Skeptical Inquirer, titled Psychic Detective Noreen Rainier, The Grinch Who Stole Christmas from a Grieving Family. One of the major issues was that Rainier shared a number of inaccurate details about the case during her sessions. For example, at one point, while channeling Kim's spirit, Rainier stated, quote, I'm going to go out the south side of the building, even though witnesses had seen Kim exiting the Canadian Tire on the north side. Rainier also said, quote, her car is taken a short distance, even though Kim did not drive to work that day, and she also stated that it seemed like it was either raining or wet, in spite of the fact that Kim went missing on a very bright and sunny day. During her first session, Rainier had hinted that Kim's remains might be found in Point Pleasant Park, but even though police performed a search there, they turned up nothing. When Constable McDonald had his second session with Rainier, she was still certain that Kim's remains were in Point Pleasant Park, which compelled McDonald to launch a second search there, but it once again came up empty. During their third session together, McDonald asked Rainier for guidance because police had received a tip from a prison inmate named Jamie Mayo, who claimed that he had witnessed two former criminal associates murder Kim and bury her body in Sir Sanford Fleming Park, which was just across the Northwest Arm Inlet from Point Pleasant Park. After Rainier said she had a vision which seemed to corroborate this story, an extensive search was performed of this park, in which two ponds were drained, but once again, nothing was found, and it would later turn out that Mayo fabricated the entire story. So in the end, Rainier did not provide any information of value, and McDonald faced criticism for wasting time and resources and allowing the investigation to be led on a wild goose chase. The next major development occurred during the spring of 1997, when investigators performed a search of a property belonging to a Halifax man in his 30s, whose name has never been released publicly. At the time Kim went missing, this man was reportedly obsessed with her and would follow her home. He worked in the Quinpool Road area in close proximity to the Canadian Tire, and had been seen talking to Kim on the day she went missing. The search of his residence contained a number of items to indicate that he was still obsessed with Kim years later, as he had photographs and missing posters for her on his walls, and had a handwritten book dedicated to her. He also had a blue knapsack, which seemed to resemble the one Kim had been carrying when she vanished, though it does not sound like they conclusively determined it was the same knapsack. However, there has been no further information released about this man at all during the past 25 years, as another promising suspect would soon pop up on the radar. On the evening of October the 6th, 1997, a 38-year-old Halifax resident named Andrew Paul Johnson was pulled over in a secluded area of British Columbia by the Nanaimo RCMP. It turned out that earlier that day, the police had received two complaints about a man attempting to lure two separate 12-year-old girls into his red 1995 Pontiac Grand Am by flashing a fake badge and pretending to be a police officer. The Grand Am was described as having Nova Scotia license plates, and when the Nanaimo RCMP spotted this vehicle and pulled it over, they discovered Johnson holding a 20-year-old woman captive. Since the woman had developmental disabilities, Johnson's scheme to lure her into his car had worked, but the police were able to intercept them before she was assaulted. When the woman said that Johnson had impersonated a police officer, he was arrested and taken into custody, and a search of his vehicle would turn up a number of disturbing items, including pornography, a meat cleaver, handcuffs, packing tape, lubricating gel, and a Halloween mask. Well, it turned out that Johnson had an extensive criminal record with numerous sexual offenses, which included tying up and raping his common-law wife, and being caught masturbating while watching some young girls. For that particular crime, Johnson received a sentence of probation and was ordered to enter a sexual offender treatment program in Dartmouth, but he had since disappeared and driven across the country to British Columbia. However, before he left the program, Johnson had been given an assignment by a psychiatrist to write an essay about a sexual assault from the point of view of the victim. Well, the details of Johnson's essay seem to outline the circumstances of how Kimberly McAndrew disappeared and contained a description of her rape and murder. Since Kim was technically only a missing person at this point, the psychiatrist found the essay to be disturbing enough to contact the police, though by the time they got involved, Johnson had left the province. Investigators would later learn that in August of 1989, Johnson's girlfriend at that time lived in an apartment complex across the street from the Canadian Tire on Quinpool Road. They were also intrigued by Johnson's ruse of using a fake police badge to lure female victims into his car. Since Kim's father worked for the RCMP, would she have been willing to climb into a vehicle with Johnson if he told her he was a police officer? Well, it turned out that Johnson was also a potential suspect in another unsolved cold case from Halifax. On New Year's Day in 1992, 18-year-old Andrea King left her hometown of Westminster, British Columbia, and boarded a flight which landed at Halifax Stanfield International Airport. After she touched down, Andrea called her family from an airport payphone to let them know she was planning to spend the night at a downtown hostel, but they never heard from her again. Andrea would remain a missing person for nearly a year until her skeletal remains were discovered in the wooded area of a business park in Halifax's Lower Sackville area on December the 22nd. When Andrea's family traveled to Halifax for a memorial service the following month, it was attended by Kim's father, Cyril McAndrew, who offered his condolences. In 1997, when Johnson was being investigated for his possible role in Kim's disappearance, police performed a search of his apartment in Halifax and uncovered a number of interesting items, including an eyeshadow compact, a pair of silver earrings, and brown leather sandals. When photographs of these items were shown to Andrea's sister, she positively identified them as having belonged to Andrea. Years later, an inquiry would be made about the possibility of performing DNA testing on one or more of these items, but unfortunately, it sounds like the evidence has gone missing and can no longer be found. By the time investigators attempted to question Johnson about his possible role in what happened to Kimberly McAndrew and Andrea King, he had already pled guilty for the crimes he committed in British Columbia, which included charges of kidnapping, attempted kidnapping, unlawful confinement, and attempted unlawful confinement. Since Johnson was still awaiting sentencing at that point, he refused to speak with law enforcement about the other cases, and he would be designated as a dangerous offender and given an automatic sentence of imprisonment for an indeterminate time period at the Mountain Institution in Agassiz. Now, the way this process works in Canada is that anyone who is designated as a dangerous offender has no chance of parole for 7 years, and they will continue to remain locked up indefinitely until a parole board determines they have been rehabilitated enough to re-enter society. Well, at the time of this recording, Johnson is still incarcerated at the age of 63 and has been denied parole on multiple occasions. In 2013, a search and excavation were performed on a property in Shad Bay belonging to Johnson's brother, but it does not sound like anything of significance was found, and thus far, no conclusive evidence has ever linked Johnson to Kim's disappearance or the murder of Andrea King. I mentioned earlier that Cyril McAndrew had been a sergeant with the RCMP, and in a cruel twist of fate, he retired only a few weeks before his daughter went missing. Cyril would spend the rest of his life actively searching for answers about what happened to Kim before he was diagnosed with cancer and passed away in September of 2004 at the age of 72. According to his daughter Megan, quote, "My dad died searching for my sister. It was really tough. Doubly so, just because that was his life after she went missing, was finding her, and you just thought there would be some kind of karma that would let it happen, but life doesn't always work that way." End quote. The government of the province of Nova Scotia is currently offering rewards of up to $150,000 for information leading to the arrest and conviction of the person responsible for Kimberly McAndrew's disappearance. But after 3 decades, there's still no conclusive answers about what actually happened to her. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. But before we continue, we would like to send out a special thanks to our sponsor, June's Journey. Putting together a podcast about real-life mysteries can be a lot of work, but sometimes you're just in the mood to get away and channel your inner Sherlock Holmes to focus on a fictional mystery, which is why June's Journey is the perfect game for you. It's a neat opportunity to travel back to the Roaring Twenties as you play an amateur detective who returns to her home after learning that her sister and brother-in-law have died in an apparent murder-suicide. But June thinks there is a lot more to this story, so she teams up with her niece Virginia to try and solve the case. You wind up searching for hidden clues to solve a number of different mysteries across thousands of vivid scenes. What's great about a mobile game based on a murder mystery is that not only are you compelled to keep playing in order to beat the game, but you also want to find out where the mystery will lead you. And since new chapters are added every week, there's always a new case waiting to be cracked. I started playing June's Journey 2 months ago, and of course I've become pretty obsessed with it, as not only is the story compelling and the gameplay easy to master, but there are also eye-popping visuals to keep my interest. If I ever need a break from researching real-life mysteries, the best way to unwind is to start playing June's Journey. There is a detective in all of us. Find your inner detective. Download June's Journey free today on the Apple App Store or Google Play. Enjoy the rest of this episode. So like I mentioned in the intro, this might be the most famous unsolved missing persons case from the province of Nova Scotia, but there's been a lot of criticism about how much time may have been wasted chasing down false leads. In November of 2009, the Halifax-based alternative newspaper The Coast wrote a rather scathing article about the Halifax Regional Police because at that time, the city had 48 unsolved homicides on the books. This gave Halifax one of the highest unsolved murder rates in the country. And of course, that stat did not even count Kimberly McAndrew, who was still technically a missing person rather than a homicide victim. A former cold case investigator named Tom Martin, who had recently retired after suffering a heart attack, spoke out for the article and said that the department had an epidemic of incompetence and indifference from the higher-ups. Martin claimed that a number of different task forces had been set up over the years in an attempt to solve cold cases, including Kimberly McAndrew's, but more often than not, these task force would be disbanded by the department's senior managers before an arrest could be made. It was Martin who wanted to have DNA testing performed on evidence found in Andrew Paul Johnson's apartment to see if they had any connection to Andrea King's murder, only for him to discover that the evidence had gone missing, so you can understand his frustration. During the early stages of the investigation, the police spent a lot of time focusing on the possibility that Kimberly McAndrew was a victim of sex trafficking, but Martin thought they fixated on that angle way too much and may have neglected other potential leads. About 5 months after Kim went missing, an informant who was a frequent customer at the Canadian Tire where she worked came forward and told the Cole Harbour RCMP that she had been abducted by a pimp shortly after she left the store following her final shift. The informant said that Kim had been forced into sex trafficking and possibly taken to another Canadian city, but when this lead failed to turn up any trace of Kim, a theory started circulating that when Kim's disappearance started generating publicity and her captor learned she was the daughter of an RCMP sergeant, they decided she was way too much of a liability and got rid of her. It sounds like investigators explored this sex trafficking angle pretty thoroughly during the first few years Kim went missing, but they never found any evidence to substantiate it. Overall, I am inclined to believe that Kim was abducted by either a random predator or someone who had a personal obsession with her, and this individual subsequently murdered her a short time later. One of the biggest issues with the sex trafficking theory is that it was provided by an unnamed informant, who are not always the most reliable sources in police investigations, and sure enough, we would also later have a prison informant provide a false story about witnessing two people murder Kim and bury her body in a park. And I guess this is the perfect opportunity to seek into Noreen Rainier's involvement in the investigation. Now, I don't want to harp too much on this angle, but I do find it amusing that Unsolved Mysteries produced a segment about her which aired in April of 1995, and Constable Dave McDonald contacted her about assisting with this investigation only about 6 months later. Kim's case was first assigned to McDonald around this time period, and he didn't have a lot of leads to work with, so I'll bet you anything that he watched that Unsolved Mysteries episode and said, eh, why not? To provide some more backstory on Rainier, she had previously worked in advertising and public relations at a Hyatt Regency hotel, but when a conference for psychics was held at this hotel, she befriended an Indian woman who showed her how to meditate, and that's when she started hearing voices and experiencing visions because she had gained psychic abilities. Even though Rhaenyra is currently in her 80s, she still maintains her own website, NareenRhaenyra.com, which mentions that she has worked with law enforcement on over 600 unsolved cases, and it features a number of quotes and testimonials from law enforcement officials about how effective she was. But the big red flag on the website is when you find out that her fee for a psychic consultation session with a police detective, which only lasts around 1 or 2 hours, is $750. So assuming that Rhaenyra still had the same rate back in 1995, her work with the Halifax Regional Police would have cost them over $2,000. If you listen to the audio of Rhaenyra's sessions for the Kimberly McAndrew case, it's pretty much the same thing you always see with psychics who assist with police investigations, as they provide very vague descriptions of certain things, such as the first letter of a location they believe is significant, but they provide no useful, concrete information. In her Unsolved Mysteries segment, they show Rhaenyra attempting to help law enforcement solve the murder of a woman named Rosemary Hom by sharing all these vague details about the crime from her visions, but then you get an update revealing that the case was solved nearly 10 years after the fact through the tried and true method of uploading the killer's DNA to CODIS and matching it to a suspect. So let's move on from the psychic angle and focus on other aspects of the original investigation. The one other detail which Tom Martin was critical of in the Coast article was the heavy emphasis on the sighting of Kim at the Gardenia Flower Shop at the Penhorn Mall in Dartmouth, as he has always believed that something happened to her before she even left the Canadian Tire parking lot. Indeed, virtually every missing persons case is going to have a number of reported eyewitness sightings which turn out to be false, yet for unknown reasons, it seems like a lot of credence has been given to the flower shop sighting, as it's still listed on Kim's profile page at the website for the National Center for Missing Persons and Unidentified Remains of the RCMP. But in my eyes, this sighting just does not mesh with the circumstances of Kim's disappearance at all. As you recall, Kim's boyfriend, her sister Heather, and Heather's boyfriend were all planning to pick Kim up at the Canadian Tire after her shift ended at a scheduled time of 5 p.m., but her supervisor allowed her to clock out early and leave at 4:21. Since it was only a 15-minute walk from the store to the apartment which Kim shared with Heather, I'm assuming that her plan was to walk back there and meet up with her sister before she left to pick her up. After all, this was 1989, so it's not like Kim was just going to call or text Heather from her cell phone to let her know she was leaving early and walking back home. But since Heather and the two boyfriends never saw Kim while driving the route from the apartment to the Canadian Tire, something obviously happened to her a short time after she left. It seems like one of the reasons investigators thought that the flower shop sighting might be legitimate is because the employee said that Kim purchased a balloon and a rose there, and since it was her boyfriend's birthday that day, perhaps Kim was buying those items as a gift. But since there was another flower shop located on the route Kim would have walked to her apartment, it makes zero sense for her to make this long detour. To put this into perspective, the Penhorn Mall is nearly 8 kilometers away from the Canadian Tire and would have required Kim to cross the Angus L. MacDonald Bridge, which runs over Halifax Harbor and separates Halifax from Dartmouth. So there's no reason for Kim to travel this distance when she did not even have a vehicle and was planning to meet her sister and boyfriend in 40 minutes. And even if someone picked up Kim and gave her a ride, I don't see why they would take her to a mall and allow her to purchase some items if they're planning on killing her. So I definitely believe this eyewitness sighting was mistaken, and Kim was abducted a very short time after leaving work. Now, we know that two people have been looked at as potential suspects in Kim's disappearance, Andrew Paul Johnson, and an unnamed male who knew her personally and apparently had a major obsession with her. But before I talk more about them, I wanted to make mention of a third person whose name has been floated around in connection to this case, and that's convicted serial killer Michael Wayne McGray. McGray is currently serving a life sentence in prison after having been convicted of 6 murders, and he wound up claiming a 7th victim when he killed a cellmate 10 years after his incarceration. McGray claims to have been responsible for at least 11 other murders which he has not yet been linked to, and when questioned about Kimberly McAndrew's disappearance, he said that she sounded familiar, but he could not remember if she was one of his victims. I briefly mentioned McGray on the Trail Went Cold episode I released just over 2 years ago about the unsolved murder of Philip Fraser, an Alaska resident who left on a road trip and was killed by an unidentified hitchhiker he picked up in rural British Columbia in June of 1988. It's been reported that McRae was looked at as a possible suspect in that case, but I think he was ruled out, since he was serving a 5-year prison sentence for his role in a robbery which took place in St. John, New Brunswick in November of 1987. And for that reason, it's not entirely clear to me why he's considered to be a potential suspect in Kim's case. Yes, McRae did live in Halifax during the mid-1980s, but even though some sources claim that McRae could be placed in the Halifax area in August of 1989, as far as I can tell, he still would have been serving a sentence for the robbery from New Brunswick. I know that by 1991, McRae had been transferred to a medium security prison in La Macaza, Quebec, and was released on a 3-day pass to spend Easter weekend at a halfway house in Montreal. Unfortunately, McRae used his newfound freedom to murder 2 separate male victims he picked up at a gay bar that weekend, and later wrote in a letter that he, quote-unquote, went on a rampage to release my rage that had built up in the previous 4 years of incarceration. So if McRae was still behind bars in August of 1989, then I think we can safely rule him out as being responsible for Kim's disappearance. So this unnamed male who was obsessed with Kim is definitely one of the most frustrating aspects of this case, because while the vast majority of sources talk about the potential connection to Andrew Paul Johnson, the only source I could find which discusses this other guy is Tim Bousquet's aforementioned article in the Halifax Examiner in February of 2016. And most of the material he shared were excerpts from another article which was published in the Chronicle Herald newspaper in March of 1998. Other than that, there's zero information out there about this individual and if he's still considered to be a potential suspect. Even in that 2009 article from The Coast, where Tim Martin was very critical and outspoken about the investigation, he made no mention of this particular lead. However, I do find it interesting that the search of this guy's residence, which uncovered a lot of material to indicate he was still obsessed with Kim, was performed in the spring of 1997, but by the end of the year, Johnson became the focal point of the investigation. So did Johnson just steal away all the attention, or did the authorities become convinced the other man wasn't involved and eliminate him as a suspect? I should mention that Canadian law enforcement is generally a lot more tight-lipped than American law enforcement when it comes to releasing certain details about criminal investigations to the public, so they may have key information about the obsessive stalker which we don't even know about. Even if he had nothing to do with Kim's disappearance, I could still see him having photos and missing posters of her plastered all over his residence because he still hadn't gotten over his obsession with her. But the one piece of evidence which could have pointed to his potential involvement was the discovery of a blue knapsack which matched the description of the knapsack Kim had been carrying on the day she went missing. I would be curious to know if this knapsack is still in evidence, because these days could probably turn up traces of Kim's DNA on it if it belonged to her. But of course we saw some items from the Andrea King case go missing before they could be DNA testing, so who knows if that knapsack is even still around. If Kim was abducted from the Canadian Tire parking lot, people have always wondered how it could have happened in broad daylight without anyone seeing or hearing anything. Well, the alternate explanation is that Kim wasn't forcibly abducted, but rather voluntarily climbed into a vehicle with someone before she was harmed at a later time. It's been established that Kim was never comfortable around strangers, but while she did know the guy who was obsessed with her and had been seen talking with him earlier that same day, the big question is whether she would have been comfortable enough with him to climb into his vehicle. Because there are so few details available about this man and his relationship with Kim, it's unclear if she was genuinely creeped out by his behavior, or if they were still on friendly enough terms that she might have been willing to accept a ride from him. But since there's very little else we can discuss about this other guy, let's get back to Johnson. It's possible that he never would have popped up on the radar as a potential suspect if not for that essay he wrote in his sex offender treatment program, where he described a scenario involving the rape and murder of Kimberly McAndrew. I mean, given that this was always a high-profile case in Halifax, it's possible that Johnson simply could have heard about her story in the news and used it as the basis to write about one of his twisted fantasies, but there's a lot of troubling stuff in his background to suggest he may have been capable of harming Kim. Since Johnson was arrested for using a fake police badge to lure a victim into his car, one of the most prominent theories is that he may have used the same tactic to lure Kim into a vehicle in the Canadian Tire parking lot in order to abduct her. However, it's worth noting that these other incidents where Johnson impersonates a police officer took place in 1997, and there's no indication that he was using the same ruse 8 years earlier. This theory is given extra weight because Kim's own father was a veteran sergeant with the RCMP, but wouldn't growing up around a police officer make one instinctively more suspicious about someone who was impersonating an officer? I mean, when Johnson used this tactic in British Columbia, he had 2 12-year-old girls refuse to get into his car because they didn't buy his ruse, and it only wound up working on a young woman who had developmental disabilities. So could this sort of thing have worked on Kim? But on the other hand, Johnson's girlfriend at the time lived in an apartment complex across the street from the Canadian Tire parking lot, so it's certainly not implausible that he could have been in the area that day and set his sights on Kim. Now, there's another unsolved crime which took place in Halifax only 2 days after Kim's disappearance, and it involved a 24-year-old woman named Leslie Ann Levy. Leslie was seen at a downtown nightclub called the Misty Moon Cabaret with a man, and they were both spotted together later that night in Point Pleasant Park. The following morning, Leslie was discovered in the park with her throat slit, and she had also been sexually assaulted. While Leslie ultimately survived the attack, she was left so psychologically damaged by the experience that she died of a drug overdose just 6 months later. Incidentally, it's been theorized that when Noreen Rainier suggested that Kim's remains could be found in Point Pleasant Park, she may have been basing this on information she dug up about Leslie's case. Now, what's truly unsettling is that Leslie worked at the King's Palace restaurant on Quinpool Road, which was also directly across the street from the Canadian Tire, and it just seems like too much of a coincidence that two different crimes involving two different young women who worked in that area would happen 2 days apart. In a 2014 article about the case, Leslie's mother, Sandra Anderson, claimed that the same man was a suspect in both Leslie and Kim's cases, stating, quote, "They had the person the night, the day after they found Leslie, and they had him down at the station. And apparently, they did have a warrant and they went to his home. But he lawyered up, and that was the end of that." End quote. So was Andrew Paul Johnson this man Sandra was referring to, or could it have been someone else? Well, as far as I can tell, law enforcement has never publicly named Johnson as a suspect in Leslie's case, even though he's an incarcerated offender and is a person of interest in a number of other unsolved cases. And once again, Johnson's girlfriend lived in the Quinpool Road area in 1989, and I'm sure he visited her apartment a lot, so he easily could have crossed paths with Leslie and decided to target her. Of course, even though it's never been conclusively proven, Johnson is considered to be a potential suspect in the murder of Andrea King, and given that she was an 18-year-old who was traveling alone and visiting Halifax for the first time, I could see a scenario unfolding where he impersonates a police officer in order to lure Andrea into his vehicle at the airport. It's also been reported that Johnson has been looked at for a potential involvement in the death of a male victim, 21-year-old Stephen Michael Hall, who was last seen alive on April the 27th, 1996, after his sister dropped him off at a gas station in the Chester Basin area. Stephen said that he was planning to visit his girlfriend and would hitchhike the rest of the way to her place, but he soon disappeared before his remains were found in a wooded area 7 months later. While Stephen's exact cause of death has never been released publicly, he was ruled to be a victim of a homicide, but it's never been made clear why exactly Johnson was investigated in relation to this case, particularly since Chester Basin is about 70 kilometers outside of Halifax. So like I mentioned earlier, Johnson's current position is kind of a unique aspect of the Canadian legal system, as he was not given a specific prison sentence for his crimes, but rather designated as a dangerous offender and given an indeterminate sentence. Now, for many of these offenders, indeterminate sentence essentially means life sentence, because unless they can make a strong case that they've been genuinely rehabilitated and are no longer a danger to society, no parole board is going to set them free. Well, even though Johnson has never been charged or convicted of any murders, I think the fact that he's considered a potential suspect in multiple unsolved homicides has always been a factor in the parole board's decision to reject him for release on multiple occasions. From Johnson's perspective, he's kind of in a catch-22 situation, because if he confesses to any murders, he's definitely going to remain in prison for the rest of his life, but unless he can be cleared as a suspect in these other crimes, there's virtually no chance he's going to be released. So given the circumstances, I see very little reason for Johnson to admit to any involvement if he's guilty, which is why he's refused to speak to law enforcement about Kim's case. While there's no direct evidence linking Johnson to her disappearance, I think that him being the perpetrator does make the most logical sense, though I have to acknowledge that we have so little information about this other individual who had an obsession with Kim, so for all we know, there might be evidence to suggest he is the strongest suspect. It's difficult to say, because this is one of those frustrating unsolved missing persons cases where the victim just seemed to vanish into thin air and there's very little evidence to work with. If Johnson did commit this crime, then at least he's going to remain locked up indefinitely and cannot harm anyone else, but I'm sure that offers little consolation to the McAndrew family since Kim's body has still never been found. So if you happen to have any information about the disappearance of Kimberly McAndrew or the unsolved murder of Andrea King, please contact the Halifax Regional Police at 902-490-5333. That's 902-490-5333. You can also send in tips to the Canadian Crime Stoppers website or call their tip line at 1-800-222-TIPS. That's 1-800-222-8477. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now, the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. This past month, I released a special bonus episode about the unsolved disappearance of Mel Wiley, a police chief who vanished from Hinckley Township, Ohio in 1985. In addition, we've dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself, Jules, and our other co-host Ashley discuss the unsolved 2004 murder of Sarah Fox. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Jonathan E., Ruth, Alyssa P., and Noel R. Thank you all so much for your support. Also, in just 2 weeks, The Trail Went Cold will be appearing on Podcast Row at CrimeCon 2022, which is being held at Paris and Bally's in Las Vegas from April the 29th until May the 1st. If you would like to purchase tickets, we already have our own personalized promo code to receive a 10% discount off a standard badge. Please visit CrimeCon.com and enter the promo code TRAIL. Once again, go to CrimeCon.com and the promo code is TRAIL. And provided that it is safe enough to travel there, I'm also hoping to appear at CrimeCon UK, which is being held at the Leonardo Royal Hotel and Spa in London on June the 11th and 12th. If you'd like to get a 10% discount on tickets to this event, please visit crimecon.co.uk and use the promo code COOL22. Once again, that's crimecon.co.uk and the promo code is COOL22. In addition, I wanted to provide another reminder that I hold live streaming sessions on a platform called Get Vocal. Every Thursday night from 7 until 8 p.m. Eastern Time, I host what is essentially an after-show for each week's podcast episode, where I have an interactive discussion about the featured case from said episode and answer questions and address comments from listeners. I always include a link to these sessions in our show notes, so be sure to check there for more information or visit getvocal.com. That's getvocal.com. I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourselves a great week and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. ¶¶